Real life.
Superpowers.
I had a conversation with my partner a few weeks ago, and we talked about money. How much money would we need to have for to have kids and to take care of the family and so on, and doing different calculations. And then she said something. She said, "Hey, stop for a moment. Yeah, we also, of course, want to have abundance and fly and have vacations and whatever. But at the end, even if we make, I don't know, $5,000 each a month, we're going to be so happy. We'll have a beautiful, small but spacious home surrounded by nature, and we'll be together and love each other and so on. Everything else is an extra." And what many times happens in the race is that we increase our expenses and we increase the expectations that we have from ourselves and what we presume that society has on us. And then we have to deliver. And then it's a race because we then continue increasing the financial expenses and the expectations. And then so that's the race. And part of what I call the real exit is exiting from that. And exiting from that does not need to even be lowering our expenses in reality. The exit is in our imagination. It's in our minds. When we realize that even if we have way, way less, and even if we don't deliver on any expectations, we can still be fully happy and fulfilled, then we can really play the game.
Welcome to Real Life Superpowers, where we delve into the journeys of remarkable individuals who are reshaping their fields and the world around them. Today, we have the pleasure of hosting Daniel Levitan, a truly visionary leader with a diverse and inspiring background, despite being only 27. Daniel's aspirations can come across as borderline delusional, but I think if anyone can achieve what he set off to, it's him. It's as Steve Jobs famously said, "Those who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do." In 2019, Daniel embarked on a profound personal journey, exploring the depth of shamanism, Buddhism, and other ancient and modern wisdom traditions. His quest for knowledge led him to study at the Haydn Mystery School and even spend a month on a deserted island, immersing himself in transformative internal experiences. By 2021, Daniel had founded and led the project called SYNC, which brought together individuals from diverse domains into cohesive groups of 12. Through his facilitations, these groups deepened their trust and coherence, creating powerful connections. In 2023, Daniel co-founded ZOE with Michael Matias. ZOE is a community of heart-driven individuals dedicated to building a sustainable, just, and beautiful world. Through online and in-personal experiences in Israel and California, ZOE fosters deep internal connections on a personal level, social level, and with nature. The gatherings focus on building trust, appreciating life's inherent beauty, aligning around shared values, and collaborating on impactful projects and initiatives. As you'll quickly hear, this is a very unique being, deeply devoted to personal growth, empowering others, and making the world a better place. We're thrilled to dive into his story and uncover the insights and experiences of this special man whose journey is really only getting started.
Real life.
Superpowers. Superpowers.
Daniel, welcome to Real Life Superpowers.
Thank you very much. I'm very, very glad to be here.
So what are you up to these days?
Yeah, so currently my main focus is ZOE, the organization I co-founded 2 years ago. We currently mainly operate in California and Israel, and soon we're also going to have an event in Costa Rica. So that's the main focus these days. Besides my close friends and very dear partner, Tal, and many other hobbies and things I like to do.
Why Costa Rica? What's there?
Costa Rica, we have a partnership with an organization called Yoko Village. It's an eco village. And they invited us to host a Zoe experience there. They bring some amazing group of people. And I'm very, very looking forward to being there. I really love Costa Rica.
So I got to ask, so Daniel, you're relatively very young and you have aspirations that are very high. Like I think most people have aspirations that are, even if they're impact driven, they're still somewhat around their personal goals. And with you, your goals are, if I have to sum them up to one sentence, they're to improve the world and make it a better place by aligning people around shared values and seeing the beauty in the world, which can sound almost delirious, but you are walking proof that you're taking actions and they're actually, you are in a sense moving the needle. So can you walk us through what the purpose of Zoe is and how it came to be, and how do you actually set such high goals and make them a reality?
So first, you know, with any goals, we can do our best and leave the rest and hope that the best would manifest and come. And in general about Zoe, I would say that if we need to sum up the core thesis of what it is and why we do it, it's realizing that we live in a very, very beautiful world, full of landscapes and nature and tastes and scents and music and many, many, many more wonders, that all of us are very fortunate to be here. And the second understanding is that there are some great challenges that we currently have in different areas. Whether it's a irresponsible acceleration in technology, or it could be that currently there is enough food produced for 10 billion people, while there is 8 billion, so 2 billion people's amounts of food is being wasted. There are many, many other challenges and problems that we face, global warming. And C, realizing that there are some very capable individuals who are also very much value-driven, truly hard-driven, value-driven individuals who are capable in different domains, who really want to dedicate their work to create a more beautiful and healthy and sustainable and flourishing world. And D is realizing that synergy has great power and potential, because 10 people that are in deep synergy can create way greater ripples of impact than 100 people who are scattered around. So bringing it all together, realizing that if we can manage to connect as many people as possible who are value-driven and capable and deepen their synergy with one another, this could truly accelerate our capacities to address these challenges and create a world that is more sustainable and more harmonious. And that's what we aspire to do.
But how do you find these people with value?
So far, we never advertised in a public way what we do or the events we do. It has been based on word of mouth. So realizing that there are not many degrees of separation between each other. So leveraging the networks we already have to bring us closer together.
Okay, and the synergy. Okay, so while I'm in this like kind of experience, okay, you're talking about synergy. How do you get the most out of that synergy? Like, at the end of the day, there's like this experience, okay? So what is that experience? How do you define it?
The experience of synergy?
The experience of getting people together and getting the best value out of them, right? So it's like these people are like in this community, but at the same time, you want them to execute things, right? So don't live the community, they work in the community, right? But you're talking about synergy. So how do you do that?
Yeah, sure. So I think an important question is to ask, what are the fundamentals of synergy first to address this question? And so far, I've realized a few. One is trust. So people who don't share trust with one another have a hard time being in synergy. The other is alignment of direction. If we have different directions, we also have a hard time to synergize. When people have both trust and direction, the capacities, the capabilities to be in synergy grow significantly. So the thing we realize is that these people that we invite, they're already entrepreneurs and investors and people from academia. They're already doers. So we don't have to push them to do things. They do them anyways. They already have their own projects that are doing amazing stuff in the world. So by focusing on creating the fertile soil, one that is creating more trust, deeper alignment with one another, what we see is that the byproduct of it is synergy and collaborations between projects, between people.
How did you end up thinking of this as a solution? How did you even tap into what you identify as the problem? And then through that, what the solution is?
Great. Yeah, thank you. I think when I was in my very early 20s, I was very much focused on my personal success and ambitions and reach different mountain peaks. And yet parts of myself were empty. I felt emptiness. Something was missing. So I tried to explore what it is. And one thing I realized was that some countries, their economy, their GDP goes up, while the rates of depression, loneliness, and even suicide also go up. So that was a bit peculiar. And I realized that some countries, their budgets, such a huge portions of their budgets are allocated towards war or arms rather than education or healthcare. So that was already also like a red flag. And there were many others, like the ocean being so polluted and many others. And I was like, that could be way better. It doesn't make sense that that's the way it is. And then I realized that on the personal experience, I experienced a similar thing. So that kind of led me to start asking questions about the fundamentals of the systems that we currently operate within. And I realized that there are a few phenomena that their convergence creates a very unique scenario. One is the phenomena of Windows Dynamics. So let's say that we both cut wood in a forest. And then I realize that if we continue, there's going to be no forest. But then I say, yeah, but if I stop and you continue, there's going to be no forest anyway. So better I continue. And you say the same thing. So we continue cutting the wood. And that happens in many other aspects. It's called arms race or tragedy of the commons. It happens in many ways. Now that connects to another phenomena, which is the acceleration of tech, the exponential acceleration. Let's say that I suddenly have an idea to invent a wood cutting machine that can cut 1,000 trees a day based AI based whatever. And I go to some VC and I tell them about the idea and they say, well, if we invest in this guy, no forests. But then one of the partners says, yeah, but if we don't, the other VC would. So better we do. And that basically, amplifies and accelerates the consequences of the Windows Dynamics. And that connects to a third phenomena, which is the misalignment between real value and incentives. So if we think about trees, for example, a tree has inherent value. It does photosynthesis and has relationships with birds and insects and so on, but it's not financially liquid. It's stuck. If we cut it into timber, it's more liquid, but less inherent value. The timber is dead already, no photosynthesis and so on. If we cut it into paper bills, even more liquidity, but less inherent value. The paper bills, they just represent something, but they are not the value itself. Most money today is actually code in the computer, right? Not even paper bills. So currently the optimization is to shift nature and relationships into goods and services, into commodities, and into bits in the computer with the sign of a dollar. So the incentives are not aligned necessarily with real value. There is a saying says, as long as a dead tree is worth more than a living one, we're going to have no forests. So that's the essence of what it is. When we ask people, what's real value for you? Many people have said to me that health, physical and mental health is real value. Close and loving relationships with their families is real value. Clean air, clean water, healthy food is real value. Creative expression is real value. Many of these things are not captured within the metric of GDP at all. When McDonald's sells more hamburgers, GDP goes up. When a company produces arms, GDP goes up. When a company pollutes, GDP goes up. So there is a misalignment between what's incentivized and what's real value for us. And if we put all these three phenomena together, what we get is a big cruise, a big ship, sailing at a faster and faster speed, not necessarily to the direction we really want to reach. And instead of gently pushing on the brake and realigning, readjusting, we put full on the gas. Because if we stop, then the Chinese will continue, or the OpenAI or Google or Microsoft or whoever.
But don't you think, like I love that, but don't you think that there's something about the dopamine sensation that at the end of the day, people don't want to work for the marathon, they want to work for the sprint, because they want to see the differences that those values will happen through synergy, because it's important enough for the community, but it'll happen in a marathon, a long time, as opposed to, you know, the hamburger that's really tasty right now.
Totally. I think what you touch here is a very, very important piece. I think one of the reasons people do that, it's either because they fear not making it and not surviving, or because they want those sensations. They desire the sensations. And that's actually, I believe, is one of the keys to make a shift, is realizing that currently in our society, we're very much dependent on intensifying external stimulants to have a deeper or a more intense experience of life. Food additives, louder music, and many others. But then what happens is that our senses, which we experience life through, they get dependent and they get more dull. So we need to intensify the stimulants even more and more and more. Now, those stimulants, there are usually resources. And resources like, I don't know, cruises or yachts or airplanes or whatever, they're scarce. We cannot have infinite resources for everyone. And when there is scarcity, there is Windows dynamics. And the whole thing goes on. So actually, I see as one of the keys to make a shift is realizing that probably the way I see it, the best metric or muscle to optimize for is our capacity to appreciate the beauty of life through our senses. Because some person could drink a cup of wine and say, wow, what an amazing wine. And somebody else would say, oh, it's just wine. So it's not just the stimulant, but our capacity to appreciate it. And when we increase that, we actually need even less and we become truly rich.
I'm really curious, because I think we will all agree that in many senses, the quality of life and the quality of the solutions that we find is based on the questions that we ask. And I see you sort of zooming out and observing, almost observing society, and then asking questions in order to identify what you believe are the core problem standing in between humanity and where it can be within its potential, and of course how it cannot deteriorate into many problems that are so core. And I'm trying to get into your mind in a sense of understanding where you get the confidence to be able to sort of silence everything, observe everything as if it's the lab, and then come up with actionable solutions where, you know, it's 2025 and there's so much philosophy throughout humanity. There's so much knowledge, deep wisdom. And yet, I think you're very humble, so I don't think you're being arrogant and I don't think you're being insane, all right? But you are coming up with new theories in this day and age, and then you're taking action on those theories. And can you try to explain where you get the confidence to do this and the clarity and the ability to sort of silence everything and move forward with what you see?
So first I want to say that I don't see it as new theories. I don't think these are things that I invented. I received them, I learned them based on different philosophers and different also inner insights, but those inner insights were based on other knowledge that I had before from other insights that I had. So I think at the end, everything is based on everything. And regarding the confidence to act on it, I guess to some degree, I have nothing to lose. I mean, I feel very fortunate. I have a very beautiful life, that I enjoy every moment of it. I have a partner that I love very dearly. I have a family that I love very much. I have many friends. I have many things that I enjoy doing. I'm very fortunate to be living here. And part of what drives me is to support more people to have better lives and also support this whole ecosystem to be more sustainable. So my children and grandchildren and their grandchildren could also continue experiencing this miracle of life.
Why do you think you can help people live a better life? And why do you think, you know, you can create the reality that will be better for the generations to come?
I think I can do my best. I don't know whether I succeeded at what degree it's and scale. I don't know. I can just do my best. Yeah, I guess at the end, our reality where we live is man-made, right? We made the roads. We invented the financial systems, the political system, all of those systems. And so the same way, we will also create the future ones. And it's a question whether we prefer being consumers or being participants in the ongoing creations and evolution of life, of reality, of everything. And for me, it excites me way more to be a creator, to be a participant in that.
Is that the way you were brought up?
Yeah. When I was young, when I was about 5, I was very hyperactive. I couldn't sit for a moment. And my parents were told that I would need to get lots of Ritalin to calm down. And they were very much not into it. And they found a school called Meitar in the north of Israel, where the concept was to bring the kids into a state of emptiness, not telling them what to do, not having any schedule, classes, nothing. And then listening to what naturally emerges from them and supporting it. So we would get to school at 8, have an hour of meditation and sharing. And then when I would have an idea, for example, one time I had an idea to create how to build houses from mud. So I shared it with one of our guides and he was, yeah, sure, let's do it. So he supported with bringing the mud and gathering other kids and we made it happen. So I think I had many early age experiences that my ideas could manifest in the real world.
Fascinating. And it makes me think how much potential there is within us when we are empowered to silence and create that emptiness and see what comes up. And I think you really answered what I was asking before, because it's sort of evident about you that you have this ability to silence things down and see what comes up. And then there's that that courage to take that the action, and perhaps that's rooted in your childhood. So did your parents also at home always empower you, like, to go your own path? Or with respect to your career?
That's a really, like, brave decision to go to, like today, even maybe a little bit less, but it's a brave decision. Like, is that part of the thesis of Meital? How much is a fundamental of what you're doing right now?
Yeah, it's definitely a big contribution to what I do now. I did not know how to read or write until I was 12. And at some points my parents were maybe got a bit scared or uneased about it, but at the end it worked out. So I guess lots of the fundamentals of Meitar are integrated in what I do and into Zoe. In many ways, and the connection to nature was very a big part there in Meitar, and also putting the main focus on the process and the conditions rather than the results. So in regular schools, there is a lot of focus about the results, the grades, the marks, all of this. There were no tests and exams and grades. They did not exist. It was all about the process, the principles, the values, and the conditions. How do we create the most fertile ground for young humans to flourish?
Wow. So it sounds like Zoe is like you've become an ambassador to that school through Zoe, it seems. But then it wasn't direct. Like you did take a rather corporate path for several years, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
It happened unintentionally, actually. When I was 17, I started to work in a gelato store selling ice cream. It was a childhood dream of mine to work in an ice cream store. And then I became a shift manager. And when I finished high school, I became the branch manager. So suddenly I had 15 employees and had to oversee the P&Ls and financials and different sorts of things. And then I continued and became a regional manager, overseeing 7 branches when I was 19. And when I was 20, I became the head of strategy and marketing of the company, overseeing 20 branches and B2B sectors and rebrandings and many other parts. So it just happened. And then I went into consulting and into other industries. So it was not planned, but somehow lots of it was based on being curious and passionate about learning new things and having new experiences.
And then you described that you felt empty, and that sort of pushed mm-hmm. you towards doing something that felt more meaningful. And it's interesting because you used the word empty both in a very positive way when you spoke about Meital and how you saw what came up, but then you were sort of driven to feel empty in a sad way or in a meaningless way when you were taking a corporate path. But were you quickly able to resolve that? I mean, it doesn't seem like an intuitive path to, you know, take the corporate career path, rise to quite unusual heights relatively based on your age, and then through that to somehow take that wheel of life and like turn it completely in the other direction towards stuff that's impact driven and to pave a road through that. Like, what did you tell yourself? How did you make that shift?
It started with leaving lots of what I knew behind, my career, my country. And I went on an internal journey of a year and a half around the world. I rented a deserted island in Finland and spent a month there, chopping wood and pumping water. I went to a mystery school learning group facilitation and different tools and skills for internal deepening. So I guess it started with not knowing what I would do next, but mainly trying to have answers for the questions I did not have answers for. And as I continued this path, new things have revealed. I think I got very curious both about systems and structures and cultures that facilitate regeneration, sustainability, harmony within oneself, between each other, with nature. And then there were different and more concrete manifestations of it, of projects and organizations that took place based on these understandings and curiosity.
Did you encounter much resistance when you returned, sort of like a young Buddha, all enlightened from that deserted island in mystery school, and things that can even be perceived perhaps awkward? How do you take all of that and then take people who are in a rather corporate race and get them to join you in this broader mission and take action?
Yeah, so I don't think I returned as a young Buddha. I was.
I'm joking, of course.
I was my old self with new insights. So I kept my older self with my insights and had some new ones. And I think at the end, lots of the beauty has to do with integration. So it's not about saying, oh, whatever we see is bad and we want everything new, because that's not reality. I mean, without the marvels and miracles of technology, we would not have been able to have this conversation or have our phones or have many amazing things that are the consequences of capitalism, of technology and innovation and of many other amazing systems. So I think first it has to be to sit on gratitude and being grateful for the current systems that we have, and then asking, okay, but now how can we improve them? And that's great. We always want to have updates and improvements, but it's without disregarding the miracles of what we have and the progress that we've made. So when we hold both, I think there is way more receptivity than saying, oh, what we do is bad. Here is something new.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, kalkalistech.com, to stay up to date on all high impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
So first of all, it touches something that I love. Like, in my opinion, entrepreneurs are like the superheroes. And like, in my, because at the end of the day, they're like game changers. I mean, they maybe they're pushing it for, you know, reasons that are very capitalistic. But at the end of the day, these are the people that shift, you know, not the governments, they shift it because of impersonal gain, interests, or, you know, value if they're, you know, super unnatural. But what's interesting in your thought, and I think it's something that you advocate really well, and you also communicate really well, and it's the fact that you know, people say it simplified, saying the journey, not the destination. Okay, so there's something about how you approach even your career by, I'm going to say this quote, you know, like it, sort of like you're not most people that you meet in the corporate art would say, you're wasting your time going to Finland, or you're wasting your time going, what's the outcome? Do you see direct value from doing that? What do you want to be when you grow up? Why are you doing this? And something really interesting for me to understand is, how would you explain your way of thought to someone who is already wired in the sense that I have to do something to get outcome? Because I think everybody today knows that indirect things that you do, Steve Jobs said that. He said, like, listen, when I went out of college, I went to this font class. I would never know strategically that would be the game changer, although everybody thought I was so smart in going that. in hindsight, I knew it connected the dots, right? And there's something about that that you advocate and communicate really well that I'd love you to explain how you explain to a wired act mind, okay, how to change that and do things that there's not direct outcome.
Sure. So I'd begin with a question for you. If you had to choose between being in hell and experiencing it as heaven, or being in heaven but having an experience of hell, what would you choose?
Am I the only person knowing this? Is it outwards or inwards? I probably choose the experiencing heaven.
Mm-hmm. And you, Noah?
I would too.
Experiencing heaven.
Yeah.
So at the core, what we realize is that we experience life subjectively, not objectively. What truly matters is our subjective experience and not the objective reality. And here is the paradox. We optimize for objective measures, whether it's GDP, profits, titles, citations, likes, followers, whatever we want to call it, in whatever. These are objective metrics, but we experience life subjectively. And this is part of the core thing. So we optimize at the end for the wrong thing. That would be the explanation.
Nice. Okay. So, let's just one a little more than that. Okay. So what you're saying is that's okay. Now, I understand the mindset, but now how do I incentivize someone to work through that? Because at the end of the day, what you're telling is at the end is something that in a psychic evolution, I would have to be very high in the pyramid. Okay. It's after even developing the idea of I don't care what people think, I care what I experience. It doesn't mean I have to be mean to people, but it means I have to, you know, it's internal and not external. So that's very high in the development, you know, like how many people are, you know, like to explain the incentive of you're doing the right thing by not doing the direct right thing. Okay. That's a great explanation, but on the practical execution, you have any tips?
Yeah, so there are a few things that could help. One is thinking about the different scenarios. I had a conversation with my partner a few weeks ago, and we talked about money. How much money would we need to have for to have kids and to take care of the family and so on, and doing different calculations. And then she said something. She said, hey, stop for a moment. Yeah, we also, of course, want to have abundance and fly and have vacations and whatever. But at the end, even if we make, I don't know, $5,000 each a month, we're going to be so happy. We'll have a beautiful, small but spacious home surrounded by nature, and we'll be together and love each other and so on. Everything else is an extra. And what many times happens in the race is that we increase our expenses and we increase the expectations that we have from ourselves and what we presume that society has on us. And then we have to deliver. And then it's a race because we then continue increasing the financial expenses and the expectations, and then so that's the race. And part of what I call the real exit is exiting from that. And exiting from that does not need to even be lowering our expenses in reality. The exit is in our imagination, it's in our minds. When we realize that even if we have way, way less, and even if we don't deliver on any expectations, we can still be fully happy and fulfilled, then we can really play the game. One of the periods of time that I really, and that was a huge gift for me, and at the same time was one of the most challenging times in my life, was when I failed, deeply failed. The team that I had faded away. I was in debt. I absolutely failed. And I felt humiliated. I felt a failure. And it was really, really tough going through that period, but it was a huge gift.
When was this?
That was, I had different failures, but the failure that I referred to now was a bit about a year and a half, or 2 years ago. And I remember walking by the beach and really feeling like I have nothing. I felt, which may not have been true, but what I experienced back then was that I lost my credibility. People won't trust me. People won't invest money in my new ventures. People would not want to join the teams that I would create and so on. And I felt like I'm nothing. And I went by the beach. And then I got a picture from a friend of mine who was in Portugal back then. And she sent me a picture with some beautiful figs. And they looked so delicious. And I said, oh, wow, even if I have nothing and I will work in a grocery store, I would still be able to get some figs and enjoy them very much. I would still be able to listen to music that I love and to see nature and then again and more and more and more. And I said, oh, wow, actually, even if I have nothing, I'm still going to be happy. And that freed me in such a deep way.
And then what did you do?
Then I did again. And that also something that I think Steve Jobs said in a beautiful way. You mentioned him earlier, that he said, I failed, but I still loved what I did. So I continued doing it. So I felt the same thing. I failed, but at the end, I couldn't really fail at that. Because when you're failing at your life mission, your life purpose, your biggest form of art, you can never fail at it. Because it's not a company that you close and then you open another one in a totally different sector. It's your life thing. You know, you cannot fail at it. You will fail. You will do it again. You will do it again. So I just did it again after learning the lessons and doing it in a better and more responsible way.
I love that. And I also think I have my two cents on Ronen's question when it comes to you, Daniel, because ever since we've met, which was several years ago, I actually even remember being in some shape or form in the background of that crisis. And sometimes I find myself telling people about you because I'm very impressed with how you think and with Zoe. And then what I find myself explaining among the values and the sort of framework that you're trying to lead is that you were able to get validation in the form of people of high profile to join you at quite early stages. And I think at the end of the day, you know, we're social creatures and I think we are seeking validation of forms. So I find myself telling people, you know, he's my friend Daniel is doing Zoe, and I explain what Zoe is, and I say, and I know it sounds almost crazy because at the end of the day, he's really trying to get a community to form around restructuring the corporate world. So instead of competing against each other in a race to a bottom, to get alignment and trust, and to actually reshape how organizations operate in the corporate ecosystem, and then I feel like I need to apologize and sort of say, because it sounds almost insane, and I say, and look, it's real because there's so many people on board across industries at high profile, so people are joining this. This isn't an idea in this dude's head. He's doing it, and I think that matters. Like I'm saying it because I think, at the end of the day, every idea that you want to execute, you try to find a way to get people on board and you try to get trust and validation so that more people join. And I think in that sense, I don't know even if it's intentional, but I think you have hacked something in that sense.
In the sense of getting trust and validation from people?
Yeah, I think it's both internal, as in part of what Zoe is all about, because it's about trust. But I think as an organization, it walks the talk because you get validation from people of high profile who say, I'm in, I'm part of this journey. And I think that helps grow. And I think it's a part of it. At the end of the day, you want to get as many people to sign, and many relevant people who are able to push the mission forward to be with you. And I think you you were able to do that. And I think there's something about how you grew up and how you operate that has helped, that has enabled you to do that from a young age. So whether it was in a corporate landscape where you felt empty, or now in this mission-driven cause, and you had mission-driven causes before that as well. But I think you have identified something.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a few things. One is authenticity. Many times when it comes to marketing, in our days, we learn different sorts, types of manipulations, basically. How to write the copy and what to say first and what to say then. And you have 36 last hours to purchase, and you have whatever, and big bold in red or whatever colors, and how to manipulate people's minds to buy things. And I think, and I also hope, that we would go more and more towards inviting people to participate. Basically, what I believe in when it comes to reaching people and inviting them to be on board and so on, has to do with sharing what it is and inviting to be part of it, sharing the full truth, the things that I'm confident in and I know, and also the things that I'm, the challenges that we still have. It's not a ready-made product that you just come and consume and get the best whatever thing. You come and you try, and you can contribute your own flavor into it. And also trusting the natural growth of things. I think in nature, there is no, you know, big God telling the trees, grow faster, we need to reach these and these KPIs and milestones. But each plant has its own rate of growth. And I tried to install the same principles in Zoe. About a year ago, it was during the war in Israel, we hosted we called it connection gatherings. And it was the first gatherings, which were 3 hours gatherings in the evening, that we opened to the public. Everyone could register. Because we felt the need at that time in the country to come together and connect. And I remember one gathering, there were a few that 30 people, 40, 50 people registered. And then there was one that we opened only for people over 70, older people. And only 5 women registered. And there were voices within myself that said, are you actually gonna do the whole thing and facilitate for 5 women for, I don't know, $100 in total? Doesn't make sense. Cancel it, reschedule until there are enough people. But then a different voice said, no, you said you're going to do it, then you do it. Even if there is one person coming, you will host a connection gathering with one other person. That's what it is. That's the commitment. And then they came, and it was one of the most amazing and magical gatherings I ever had. A few of them cried, and they said they never felt what they felt in 30 years. And that kind of taught me a lesson, that it's not about the quantity, it's about the quality. And the only thing we can really do is making sure that our instrument is in integrity, is sharp, it's attuned, and do our best, and then trust the rest. And sometimes 5 people would come, and sometimes 100. Just like in nature, sometimes you go fish and you have one fish, and sometimes there is a huge whatever bulk of fish coming. So you never know. But the only thing you do know is that you need to be there with your fishing rod and do your craft. So I think that's also something that really supported Zoe to grow so far in a way that for me feels true and organic.
So true and organic, but I want something that listeners, I really want them to hear. I really love the story also about the figs. I'm going to go back to that for a second, because I think I think there's a really big insight there for any entrepreneur, anybody who's doing anything as brave as you have. And I really think that every business, you know, at the end of the day, an entrepreneur is a person, you know, an inner child, a person who has a dream and he's trying to, you know, either express himself or get that dream out. And it's a very brave thing to do. And when people feel failure, which entrepreneurs have to feel a lot of failure and a lot of reject and a lot of negativity, okay, that thought process about the figs is a beautiful poem of inspiration for people, for entrepreneurs to understand. And I want, like, you to understand this very well, because it's something that you only understand later on after failure, okay? And I think it's beautiful, because at the end, what you did is you're thinking rationally that about all the major bullshit that are externally feelings, okay? Meaning that at the end of the day, if you tried hard enough for the right reason, which was aligned with what you told people you're going to do, and you failed to do that, it is not a failure, okay? But because no one can, you know, at the end of the day, there's so much external things to do. But the process is a whole story. It's like a book. The thing is how it ends at the end of the day and what you did all your life to get to there. And in the meantime, you can't have failure by trying hard to get there. Okay, like you'll still have the can't. No one can take away, you know, your imagination, your appreciation, your figs. No one can take that away. So there is no such thing as failure. The failure is when you give up and you say, "I don't deserve those figs." As an entrepreneur, you said a few lessons, but I really think, like, this is academically one of the reasons that there is less businesses in the world. It's actually about 45% of people have a fear of failing. Okay? And it's not real failure. It's not failure in life. I can't have kids or I'm going to die. Okay? Which also isn't a failure, but let's say it's the game over. Right? And that's like a thing that if you take away that fear of failing, okay, like let's say the mud is in Metal, it's a bad idea. Someone would say, "What the hell? It's a bad idea. What are we going to do with mud? Make houses of mud." The same thing is just out of fear of not having that. In that sense, I think that's, you nailed something very important that I want people to hear. I really like that story.
Thank you. There is actually a technique that helps me to shift from a mindset of a victim to a mindset of a creator.
Please teach. Please.
And it's... when I was younger, I loved playing computer games. And when you play computer games, you can choose the level of difficulty of the game. You can be a beginner, medium, hard, expert, whatever. Then if you choose expert and it gets very tough, you don't become a victim and blame the system. You chose the level of difficulty, right? It was your decision, your choice. You can go easy. Now in life, essentially it's a game. There are some challenges and there are some opportunities, and we have different tools to go around. And each one of us got different cards and different tools we can play with. Some have super high intelligence, some have super high social skills, some have lots of money from their families, some have lots of connections, some have... obviously, for a person in Africa who has nothing, it's going to be very hard to I don't know, build a billion-dollar company versus, I don't know, the kid of Bill Gates. So some have better cards, or in other ways we can call it, they got an easier level of difficulty in this game. Some got a harder one. But no matter what level you got, you can win the game. That's for sure. And so... The way to see it is saying, okay, let's throw all the past that has happened to the trash bin. That doesn't matter. That doesn't exist. That was the past. What happens is where I am now and the tools that I have. And yeah, it's challenging because this level of difficulty may be, I don't know, the medium difficulty or the hard one, but it's also interesting. And for sure, it's winnable. So... But what helps us, the thing that helps is that when I play a computer game, I'm way less identified with the main character than I am identified with myself when I'm playing the game of life. So when my character has a challenge, I don't get depressed and anxious and crying and get frozen, right? I'm like, okay, it's interesting. Let's see, maybe I can push this button or go there. So the more we're able, when we are in challenging times, shift out of our personal identity and for a moment see it as a character within a game and see there are different conditions and see what could support us, then I think that could really shift very, very easily to a different mindset.
So you're saying that you actually choose. So if someone understands that he chooses the level of difficulty, okay, and he can always go down a level of difficulty and always challenge himself to go up, okay, then at the end of the day, and you understand that at the end of the day, there's only one game over, which is death, okay, then all the mindset is a lot more playful and less dramatic, right? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. At the end, it's a game. And when we become a bit less identified with the main character, which is us, we can actually play the game. And it becomes more fun and more playful.
I love that. And Daniel, I think that the Zoe mission, I think you'll agree, it starts with relationships between people. How can people apply some of this thinking to their day-to-day communication in a way that can perhaps, you know, because it's all about the small steps. If you set a goal and you try to get from 0 to 100, it's probably going to fail, right? Like that's an expert level of a game that we're not playing really at the moment. So assuming that we do want to get this vehicle of society on a track towards growth instead of deteriorating in a theory of a race to the bottom through competition and corporate agendas. So how can people apply this in the day-to-day communication and to stop, you know, treating other, you know, competitors as the enemy and just people that you interact with in a day-to-day matter? How can people sort of see the better good without feeling that they're risking themselves too much?
Yeah. So I think one of the key techniques there is being able to construct a shared narrative. Now, a shared narrative happens on many levels or many fractals. It happens on the level of a state, for example. If we take the state of Israel, where we all came from, in its beginning, we had a narrative of Altneuland, of creating a new democratic and Jewish state. And then no matter whether you lived in that kibbutz or that kibbutz, we were together in that. And then we gradually kind of lost the connection to that shared narrative and it became more individualistic. So the core aspect to be able to have synergy and create a win-win scenario instead of win-lose in competition is seeing a shared narrative, a shared story where we both win. And the way together is through authenticity and transparency. Once we can share with somebody else our intentions, our struggles, our challenges, instead of pretending to be strong and knowing and having a very lucrative offer and then negotiating on those offers and having those power dynamics of who wins and who loses, saying, hey, these are the conditions where I am. These are my intentions. I would love to hear yours. And then when we have all the information that we need, let's construct together a narrative where we both win.
Do you have an example?
Yeah. In other aspects, we can see it as like, it comes again to the role of identification. For a moment to disidentify with ourselves and them and see it as two other entities trying to find a story where they both win. If you want to take an example, I think the one that comes to me was when I was I was in California, and I went to an art gallery that 10 years ago got many paintings from my dad, who was an artist, and did not pay for them. Basically, my dad tried to reach them, and they disappeared. So it was kind of a traumatic experience in our family. And I happened to be in that neighborhood of the art gallery, and I went there. And I shared with them what happened. In the beginning, it was a very separated conversation of who was right and who was wrong, and a negotiation, and it kind of like went into a very toxic direction. And I realized that if we continue to negotiate and have this toxic conversation, that's no way gonna go into a healthy solution. And then there was a moment that I said, hey, guys, let's stop it for a moment. And I shared my experience with them as a child, how it was for me, and said, look, I don't know how it was for you, and I'm sure you may have a different truth, but I just want to share my truth. And I shared it fully. I was vulnerable. I was truthful. And then I was like, I'm also very curious to hear how it was for you. And then they shared their part. They said, yeah, we actually did try to reach out, but then it didn't work. We did not have the address, and we're sorry for this, for that. And then we said, okay, so here's a solution, a situation, and let's see how can we together create a scenario that does not continue what happened in the past, but creates a new possibility for the future. One that is based on trust, on connection, on fairness. And then suddenly we became a team trying to work together to construct a different solution. And it worked. And we actually happened to construct a solution where they did pay some small amount, but they also put my dad's paintings in a way that was more in the front. And then there was a way that we try to support their gallery, and suddenly we became allies and created a win-win situation. And the core aspect was the question, how is it like to be you? Because once I really understand how is it like to be you, and you understand how is it like to be me, then we are less separate entities and can come more together into intimacy, and then we can become a team.
And do you think that always applies? Because what if they genuinely just thought only of themselves, they wanted to steal? You know, people do have mal intent. It's not always circumstantial.
Of course, it may not have worked. This time it worked. I'm sure there are other opportunities where it doesn't. I don't think there is a kind of like bulletproof solution that always works. But I think we can try it and find those that it does work with and work together. And realize that at the end, it's more it's more competitive to be in synergy than not to be in synergy. So at some point, also the egoistic, malicious actors would rather be truthful and trustful and in synergy, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to advance in the game. But that could happen later on. First, we want to gather with those that we already can do it with.
And how can people take part in Zoe? Is this mainly retreats? Is this events?
Yeah, so it's a global community currently mainly happening in California, in Israel, also a few people from Europe. Lots of it happens online as well. So people can opt in and be part of it. What happens when you become part of it is that you're curated into a group of four people that from all of the community, we curate them for you based on the things that you care about the most, your challenges, your gifts, and other questions. And you go on a journey with them to build trust, to align around your values, and to see how you create win-win scenarios and synergy with one another. And then every three months, you get a different group. So gradually, you get more and more deep connections with very relevant people who share similar values of you. And besides this, there are in-person retreats. We just had one in Israel. We're going to have one in 2 weeks in Costa Rica, in California afterwards.
And what typically comes out of those deep connections? How does that tie down to the bigger mission?
A few things. One is, I call it non-intense collaborations. So there is intense collaboration where we have a shared task manager and Slack and work on a project. Non-intense collaborations is introductions. I can sometimes, we had an event in Portugal, and at the end of it, there was an entrepreneur who had a startup doing regenerative agriculture in Africa, and he shared that for 6 months he's trying with all his force and will to get a specific regulatory permit for what he does. And he wasn't able to reach that the person who is responsible for it. And a woman at the other side of the room said, "What? I know her. I'm going to connect you now." And he was in shock. So these things are some of the results and byproducts that happen.
The power of community.
The power of community, the power of some, my gift can be huge for somebody else. And for me, it can be just a message or an email. So these non-intense collaborations that can happen where there is win-win, friendships that could last for life.
And how can people find Zoe online?
So our website is zoe.garden, Zoe.garden, Garden. We also have our Instagram, Zoe Connection. You can find us there as well, and also on LinkedIn.
And do you have any plans to expand this beyond Israel and California and the current locations?
Totally. I think the online part of it is already gathering people from different areas across the world. And as we continue, we also have in-person experiences and retreats in other countries, probably in Europe soon.
Daniel, I personally very much believe in you, and I think your cause couldn't be worthier. So I'm rooting for you. And I hope that in a few years from now, we'll be speaking in Zoe with something that doesn't even need introducing because it's so well known and so successful.
Yeah, totally. I hope so. So,
what would your superpower be?
My superpower? I guess my superpower would be to realize when I'm not truly connected to myself and know how to make an internal shift to see the world as a loving and beautiful place again and again.
So you'd say consciousness control. Control of consciousness, maybe.
Consciousness, awareness, and optimism.
And your kryptonite?
Kryptonite? I have a hard time with the kind of, or I have a part time when people are compliant and are like a group of sheep, not really open mind, and this can really get me angry and out of my center in a way that may be unproductive.
And then you start to not identify with it and see it from their end, maybe.
In the good day, when I'm managing to address my kryptonite in a healthy way.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, both of you. Very much appreciating the time.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real life.
Superpowers.
Life.
Superpowers.